Go ahead and turn your Bible today to Romans chapter 9. If you're borrowing a Bible, go ahead and turn to page 773. That'll land you in Romans 9. We're starting in verse 30. I heard this story told one time of a man who was living in the United Kingdom for a period of time. He was finishing his education. I think he was working on his doctorate degree. And so he was living in the United Kingdom just for a couple years with his wife and kid. His whole family moved there with him. And so they were living in the United Kingdom. And if you don't know anything about the United Kingdom, just like myself, you might know one thing, and that is that they have a queen. Everybody knows that about the United Kingdom. And that's the only thing I know. And that's exactly where I'm going. I'm not pulling any punches. That's exactly where I'm taking this story. And so they heard of this big parade that was going on. And I don't mean just a big parade. I mean like 1,400 British soldiers and 200 horses and 400 musicians were going to be making an entrance at this parade. But if that isn't enough for you, the royal family and the queen themselves were actually going to be at the parade as well. So the dad thought this is a great moment to introduce his kid to some like the British culture and tell him about what the queen does, more so what the queen doesn't do, and just all this stuff about just moving into the United Kingdom and how they were how the culture was. So they were going to take this kid to the parade, leave mom at home, give her a day off. It was just going to be a dad and son bonding trip to see the queen. They actually get there, and they're right in front. They're right at the gate. Nobody's blocking their view. There's not this really tall person blocking the little kid from being able to see anything. They're right in front. They have a perfect view of everything they need to see at the parade. And then when I think of parade, I think of like the Macy's Day Parade where there's like inflatable SpongeBobs and like candy being thrown at you. And this was not at all like that. And in fact, the son was like pretty bored because there weren't any inflatable SpongeBobs and there weren't any Tootsie Rolls or Laffy Taffys to be snacking on. So he thought that it was a pretty boring parade. I mean, the only thing that was really all that entertaining were the ridiculous hats that all the British soldiers wore. But apart from that, nothing else was really that cool. That was until he saw the carriage. There had been other carriages, but this one was something else. The music started to play something more elegant, something more pretty. I mean, the carriage was decorated on the outside with these neat little plants that were beautiful, and there were some lights covering the top of the carriage. It was amazing. The person directing the carriage, he wasn't wearing this ordinary red suit like everybody else was wearing. He was wearing a gold suit that only he was wearing. And the horses that were pulling this carriage, I mean, all the other horses had been fine, but these horses were beautiful. Everything mattered when the carriage came around. The wheels on this thing, they looked like they had been taken right off the back of an old Model T car. The wheels were so cool. There was no other carriage like this one. Well, eventually this carriage had come their way, and eventually it had passed and moved on to visit some other people. And so the people in their area started to get up and head out, go to their cars and head home. And the same is true for the dad and the son. So the dad is all jazz, and he's like, son, what did you think? Like, did you like it? And he said, oh, it was okay. He's like, okay, that was one of the coolest things ever, just okay. Well, you must have had a favorite part. What was your favorite part? And without even hesitating, without even taking a breath, the son said, the carriage was. And so dad starts to rack his brain a little bit, the carriage. There's a lot of carts and carriages that are pulling floats and horses and all these different things. But admittedly, there was one carriage that was far cooler than any other carriage, and that was the one that was pulling the queen. So the dad said to the son, he said, oh, do you mean the carriage that was pulling the queen? And the son said, what queen? Being so enamored and focused on the carriage, the son had totally missed the queen that was riding inside of the carriage. Today, my friends, you can be in the presence of royalty too, yet still miss the point. Be looking at the wrong things. That's exactly what Paul is talking about here in Romans 9, actually, where we pick up. He's talking about the same frustration with the Israelites, some Jewish people, and how they missed the point. He begins here in verse 30. It says this, what then shall we say? That the Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness have obtained it, a righteousness that is by faith, but the people of Israel who pursued the law as the way of righteousness have not attained their goal. Why not? Because they pursued it not by faith, but as if it were by works. They stumbled over the stumbling stone. As it is written, see, I lay in Zion a stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. And the one who believes in him will never be put to shame. But the people of Israel who pursued the law as the way of righteousness have not attained their goal. Later on in the next verse, actually, in chapter 10, Paul says this, Brothers and sisters, my heart's desire and prayer to God for the Israelites is that they may be saved. For I can testify about them that they are zealous for God, but their zeal is not based on knowledge. Since they did not know the righteousness of God and sought to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. What Paul is talking about here about the Jews or the Israelites who followed the law, he's talking about the Torah. Now, the Torah is actually the first five books in our own Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the first five books that we read in our own Bible. And it's called Torah because Torah means law. And in these five books are 613 laws. They're really creative with their naming, so they just call it the law. And it's just filled with these laws. Now, these laws were actually the guideposts for how people of Israel, how Jews structured their lives. Everything was around following these laws. And you might be thinking, dude, that's way too many laws. And you're right. Like 613 is a lot of laws. Because if that's your only way of righteousness, if that's the only way of making sure that you are good, even if you fail to follow one out of the 613 laws, you are unrighteous. For example, you kill somebody just one time, you're a murderer. If you lie just one time, you're a liar. And if you cheat just one time, that makes you a cheater. And so they structured themselves around being a rule follower, following all these laws. But Paul is pointing out that when the people of Israel have tried so hard to follow every single one of these laws, they're really missing it. He says in verse 4, Christ is the goal of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. In other words, the entire reason this law exists is because of Jesus. He was the point all along, and Israel was trying so hard to obey all the rules that they missed the person of Jesus. They were looking so intently at the carriage that they missed the royalty inside of it.
Israel was trying so hard to obey the law that they missed the person of Jesus. Now, the Israelites had this law as a framework for their life. So every action, every decision, every word and thought, I mean, it was shaped in every way by this law. So the purpose of their life, the goal of all of their actions, was found in these 613 laws. But in framing their lives around this, they missed Jesus. Which leads me to ask myself, what am I framing my life around? When I look at my actions, my decisions, my words, and my thoughts, what is my goal? What is my purpose? Do I see Jesus in that? Now, I'm 3/4 of the way done with a children's ministry degree, and I spend most of my Sundays teaching kids, not really adults, so my mind just kind of thinks in object lessons. I hear a Bible story, and I start thinking of a science experiment to go along with it. And quite frankly, I don't really feel like adults get enough object lessons. You can disagree with me on that one if you want to, but I'm going to give you one today to make up for it. So some of you might be familiar with the story in Matthew 7, the parable of the wise and the foolish builders. But if you're not, I want you to picture with me two completely different guys. And they're both looking to go and buy a house, but very quickly realize that's impossible in Spring Hill right now, so they're just going to build their own. So they set out to build a house, and the first guy decides he's going to build it right on the beach. So he finds this nice little plot of sand, and he gets his house all situated on right on the beach, every person's dream, right? So he gets all settled right there. Well, the second guy doesn't really want to sweep up sand all day, not really into the beach, so he decides he's going to find a nice rock, and he's going to build his house there. So they both get settled in, they're comfortable, they're just moving into their house, and then one day there's this huge storm, okay? I mean, there is wind and thunder and lightning, and there is a whole ton of rain. And as the rain comes down, my guy over here on the brick, like, he's pretty fine, he's a little wet, but pretty comfortable, while my friend over here, as his house falls over, my friend over here, the sand crumbles, and his house is destroyed, and everything that he had is lost, because it couldn't withstand the storm. And Jesus tells us this story in Matthew 7 to demonstrate the difference between people that obey the word of Christ and people that don't. So this is what he says in Matthew 7. It says this, "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on the sand." So the wise man, the one that built his house on the rock, he was listening to the words of God, while the foolish man, house on the sand, his foundation crumbled, he did not listen to the words of God. It's pretty simple, right? And the difference between these two men was never who heard the word of God, because they both did. The difference was who obeyed it. The difference between the wise man and the foolish man was in what they decided to put their foundation on. And as the storms and hardships of life became present, only one of those foundations could actually survive. And in the same way, the difference between our lives failing or flourishing is all in our foundation. And when we put our foundation in anything other than Christ, it's not going to last. We're foolish. It's temporary. It's not eternal. So I ask again, what are we building our lives on? What are we framing our foundation around? The actions, decisions, words, and thoughts, do we see Jesus in that? Because so often I find myself filling my life with things that are good, good actions, good thoughts, good words, that I miss Jesus. Because I can become the most successful person in every single aspect of my life, but if I don't know Jesus, then none of it matters, and it's going to crumble. So a few weeks ago, Dane, Noah, and I got to go to elementary camp, perhaps with a few of your kids, and it was just a blast. I mean, seriously, it was one of my favorite weeks of the whole summer, and I loved it. The kids loved it. They learned so much more about God, and we just had a great time. And so we got up to the camp. We got settled in Kentucky, the dorms that they have there, and we go to find out who our small group is. And I learned that for the week, I'm going to be hanging out with a bunch of first graders who are super cute, but this is their first time really away from home, especially for a week, right? And so I very quickly learned that everything was a big deal. I mean, everything. So remembering to shower, remembering to put your shoes on, remembering to brush your teeth. It's just these little things that they weren't totally used to doing completely on their own. So it was all a big deal, but it was so much fun. And so one day we go to lunch and we sit down in our small groups, and one of my little first graders, he gets in line with his tray to go get some lunch. And we find out that we're having hot dogs with nacho cheese and chili. I mean, every kid's dream. He was thrilled about it. So he waits through the entire line. He finally gets his food, and he comes and sits down next to me with his tray. And then he gets to work preparing his hot dog. But like I just said, everything's a big deal. So this was no simple task, right? I mean, this was huge. So he takes one chip and he scoops up every single ounce of nacho cheese and chili, carefully placing it just how he wants it on his hot dog. And I'm not lying to you, this was a full 10-minute process. For 10 minutes, the kid did not look at anyone else. He did not talk to anyone else. He was dead focused, scooping with his chip and putting it on his hot dog. So it was just the way that he wanted it to be. And then he taps me on the shoulder after 10 really long minutes, and he's really proud of me. He's like, look what I made. Look how good this looks. And I congratulated him. He did a great job. We went through the whole thing. And he goes to take his very first bite. But like I said, it had been like 10 minutes. So by this point, every other kid in the cafeteria has done eating, right? Everyone else is done with their lunch. So as he goes to take his first bite, the kitchen manager pops her head out of the kitchen and yells, seconds, which means if you want to, you can go back and get another hot dog. So he hears this right as he's starting to take a first bite, and he gets really flustered. I mean, the kid was overwhelmed. So he shoves the entire hot dog into his mouth. There is cheese dripping off of his chin as he picks up his tray and runs, cheeks full of hot dog, to get back in the line and get another one. And it was the funniest thing that I have ever seen in my life, because this kid worked so hard on a hot dog that he barely even tasted. He could not have told you what that hot dog tasted like. And the point was never about making the hot dog. The point was about eating it. And this kid, I mean, he worked so hard. He tried harder than any other kid in the cafeteria, I promise you. But he missed the point. Some of us work so hard at our careers to provide for our families that we miss our families in the process. Or maybe some of us work so hard at building a house and remodeling a house that we miss our home in the process. And in the same way, some of us work really hard doing all of the right things that we miss Jesus in the process. And thinking of the story of this kid reminds me of the story of Mary and Martha in the Bible. So Mary and Martha are two sisters that were friends with Jesus, and they decide one day to invite Jesus over for dinner, right? And so Martha gets busy preparing all the things that she needs to do. So I would imagine she's cooking all of the best food, she's deep cleaning her house, doing all the laundry and the chores, all the things that she'd been pushing off because Jesus is coming over. And I can't even blame her, because if you invite the Savior of the world over for dinner, you're not throwing out Kraft mac and cheese. Like, this is a really, really big deal. So she is working so hard doing all of those things, while Mary, her sister, is sitting at the feet of Jesus. She's talking to Jesus, listening to his teachings, sitting as close as she can to Jesus. Well, this makes Martha pretty upset, right? Because she's doing everything all by herself, and who wouldn't be mad about that? So this is what she says to Jesus. She says, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work all by myself? Tell her to help me." And this is how Jesus responds. He says this, "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you are worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, or indeed only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her." What Martha was doing was not bad. Cleaning and cooking and preparing your house for Jesus are not bad things. Those are good that have to be done sometimes. But what Mary was doing was essential. Mary was focused on her relationship with Jesus before anything else that had to be done. That was her top priority. And so while Martha worked so hard and tried so hard and put in good effort, she missed the point of the entire evening, which was to spend time with Jesus. She missed it. And that is where we find ourselves. We spend our lives doing a lot of things, most of which are good and important, but so often we miss the point. And this is where the Israelites were. They were so focused on creating their own righteousness that they forgot to discover the righteousness of God. And the Israelites were not able to create their own righteousness. And though I try time and time and time again, I too am unable to create my own righteousness. I cannot make my life more full of fruit or live a life of meaning apart from Jesus, and neither can you. I cannot make my life more full of love and joy and goodness and kindness and patience apart from Jesus, just from trying harder or from saying all of the right things or from being good enough or from being the smartest, the funniest, the most successful person in the room. None of those things are possible unless I focus on Jesus. That's not possible for me to do on my own. My job, your job, is to be as close to Jesus as possible. That's our role. That's what God asks of us. And yet so often, I miss that. I stand in the face of royalty, and I miss it. And Paul tells us in Romans 10, "Christ is the goal of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes." So when we take the framework of our lives, and we pull from it one unifying key factor, is it Jesus? When I look at all that I'm striving towards, all of my goals, all the things I'm working for, do I see Jesus in that? When I look at the ways that I fill my time, the way that I structure my days, is my goal Jesus? Because if it's not, Paul tells us that we have come so close, we have tried so hard, but we've missed it. Because our framework, our motivations, our purpose, it all has to come back to Jesus. That's our job. So let's do something together, if you would. Read this verse with me. It says, it's John 14, 15. It says, "If you love me, keep my commands." So I want you to read that, and I want you to sit with it for a second. Decide, where does this verse leave us? What is this verse telling me to do? If you're anything like me, I read that and I say, well, shoot, I need to be trying a lot harder. Because if you give me 60 seconds, I can list for you time and time and time again that I have not kept Jesus' commands. I can give you a really long list of sins and shortcomings and ways that I maybe was trying, but I was not following what Jesus asked me to do. And so I read that verse and I think, I've got to do a lot better. I've got to be more, I've got to do more, I've got to try harder because I am not doing that well. But I don't think that that is what that verse is saying. I think that verse is telling us that if we love Jesus and we are close to Jesus and we are in good standing with Jesus, focused on our relationship with him above everything else, then the rest of that works out. My ability to keep Jesus' commands doesn't really come from trying harder. It comes from an overflow of my love for Jesus. If I love Jesus, I will keep his commands. It's a natural part to that. And so my ability to do this well comes from staying as close to Jesus as I can. My ability to live the best life that I can live and follow all that God has asked me to do comes when I am close to Jesus.
What happens, though, if we do miss the point? What happens if we're in the face of royalty, yet we miss it? Jesus says this in Matthew 7. He says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name drive out demons, and in your name perform many miracles.' Then I will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.'" Now, I'll be honest, this one is tough. I mean, there's something in me, there's something in you that takes pride in doing good things. I might even supplement some of these things that I do into this passage. Follow with me here. "Lord, Lord, did I not tell the truth? Did I not treat others as I wanted to be treated? Did we not forgive people? Did we not have integrity? Did we not stay faithful to our spouses? Do we not give money to those who are homeless and in need of money?" And these are good things. I hope you do all of these things because you want to. All of them are good. But the question isn't, did you do those things? The question is, did you know Jesus? Maybe you're in the room like I am, putting a lot of my effort into being a good person, or being moral, or being an upstanding, respectable person. That's a good thing. I want people to think that I'm kind, or I want people to think that I'm a loving person, and I hope you do too. Yet while we strive for these things, I think we've missed the point. Just like the Jews did, just like the kid at the parade did. It's funny, I don't think the world is in short supply of nice people. I mean, there's nice people at every restaurant you go to, every Lowe's home improvement store you walk down, every country you go to, there's nice people. I hear the phrase a lot, "He's such a good guy." And that's a good thing. There isn't a shortage of good guys. There isn't a shortage of nice people. I do think, however, there's a shortage of people who are laser-focused entirely on the person of Jesus. Perhaps you're in this room right now for one of the first times, or maybe you're just checking out this whole Jesus thing. This chapter ends in chapter 10 with a verse that I think is for all of us today. It says this, "But concerning Israel, he says, 'All day long I've held out my hands to a disobedient and obstinate people.'" It's funny that it begins with "concerning Israel," because I think it could also say "concerning Spring Hill." I mean, if we admit it, we are sometimes disobedient and sometimes an obstinate, stubborn people. Yet Jesus still holds out his hands for me and for you. It's okay that we're disobedient sometimes. It's okay that we're stubborn sometimes, because all day long his hands are held out. Jesus still wants you and he wants me. And it's possible that we miss it. It's possible that we continue trying our hardest to do the right things and to focus on being a good person, being a moral person. But that's just building your house on sand. Today, we have a great opportunity to focus on Jesus. It might be really easy to watch the carriage go by, go from one end to the other, and just be so enamored by the things, by the carriage, by everything else. But today, it's also an amazing time to look into the face of royalty. Will you pray with me? Father in heaven, you say that you did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law. God, you're not just a byproduct of all of these things. You are the point of all of this. God, admittedly, we are prone to trying our hardest, trying our absolute best. And so, God, right now we recognize that we miss it sometimes. That when we're trying our hardest to do things, fill in the blank, God, we're missing the person of Jesus. So forgive us for the times that we've done that. Forgive us for the times that we've looked at everything else apart from you. And God, help us this week to focus more on you. God, help us to look into the face of royalty. It's in your son's name.